Welcome to the Beverage Report. In our previous episode, we were joined by Professor Oliver Hart, winner of the 2016 Nobel Prize in Economics. We discussed his pioneering work on contract theory. Today, we continue this fascinating discussion, diving into his recent engagements and work on corporate social responsibility.
In 2019, you acted as an expert on behalf of Qualcomm when Qualcomm sued Apple over their alleged infringement of patents. Could you tell us a bit more about this experience?
Yes. Wasn't it Apple? So in my part of the case, I think, which, by the way, you know, it was settled, I think, on day two of the trial. I was ready to go out to San Diego and testify, but didn't happen. But I was deposed and so on. The case, there were several kind of interlocking cases involving those two parties. But what I recall is that Apple and Qualcomm had this contract whereby Apple was using Qualcomm intellectual property and also a chip they made to put in their iPhones, you know, the very things we all use. They'd agreed, I think, back in 2006, I may not be getting the years exactly right, but something like this, that they had agreed on a royalty sharing agreement whereby Qualcomm got 5% of the revenue from each phone. There were some subtractions, so it's not exactly 5% of the price, but it was sort of not too far from that. As Apple phones, you know, iPhones became incredibly popular, you know, huge market, what this meant was that Qualcomm was getting 5% of a very large number. And Apple decided, you know, it's too much. We don't want to pay this much. We don't think Qualcomm deserves that much. And so they basically breached the contract. And then there was litigation. And I was hired to be an expert for Qualcomm. And from my point of view, the case was extremely simple because, you know, there was a contract. It wasn't an incomplete contract. At least, you know, 5% means 5%. Didn't seem to be. And Apple had agreed to it. And the idea that later on, when it turns out you're paying a lot for something, that you can say, you know what, I want to change my mind now. I want to change the terms. Seemed to me outrageous, frankly. You know, would they, if it had been 5% of a very small number, would they have gone back and said, you know what, we're paying you much too little. We're so sorry. We want to increase the amount. Of course they wouldn't. 5% was a sort of agreed in good faith. And the way to think of it is that, you know, in some circumstances, the phone's going to sell very well, and it's going to be, as I was saying, 5% of a large number. In some other circumstances, maybe the phone is going to be a bust, and it's going to be 5% of almost nothing. And you know, you're sort of averaging over all those events, good and bad. And so I thought Apple to now attempt to renege on the contract was just you know, extreme opportunism. It's sort of like hold up. And I didn't think it should be permitted. And but it was quite remarkable that Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, was, you know, basically was saying, well, it's just not fair. They, you know, they're getting paid too much. They don't deserve it. That it's not fair. As if somehow, you know, the contract didn't mean anything. It was settled. What it does show, actually, if I just, and it sort of does, as I say, relate a little bit to hold up. You know, if you're a big player, you can throw your weight around if you choose, and maybe get away with it. You know, it's the terms of the settlement were not public, so I don't exactly know. I think Qualcomm did reasonably well out of it, but as I say, I don't think the case should have been brought at all.
True, that makes sense. Well, we'd love to talk a little bit more about your recent work too, which is focused on corporate social responsibility and shareholder welfare maximization. You've been working on a theory for this in your paper called The New Corporate Governance. So firstly, could you describe to our listeners the difference between shareholder value and shareholder welfare maximization and why you believe the latter is better?
Yes, happy to do that. Well, just a little bit of background. For the last 50 years or so, it's sort of been taken for granted, or it's the conventional wisdom in finance, law, and economics that the proper objective of a company, particularly a public company, by which I mean one whose shares are traded on stock markets, that kind of, you know, big company like Apple or Microsoft or BP, the wisdom has been that those companies should be maximizing profit, or to be more precise, market value, share price. And this is what, when people talk about shareholder value maximization, that's what they mean. Why do people have people thought that? You know, one of the people we can blame is Milton Friedman, who wrote an article in 1970 in the New York Times. But in fact, it was also already in his book, Capitalism and Freedom, back in 1962. And his argument was companies should act on behalf of their shareholders. And what do shareholders want? They want to be as wealthy as possible. And that's why companies should maximize their wealth or the share price. And he argued that this is true even if shareholders are socially responsible and, for example, care about poor people, want to get, or, you know, people in regions of the world which are experiencing hurricanes or tornadoes, whatever, or poverty. He said, yeah, that of course there are people like that, and that's good. And but they can do that, let's say, charitable giving by themselves. They don't need a company to do it on their behalf. So at the time, companies were, and it's still true, were giving money to charity rather than paying a higher dividend to shareholders. And Friedman argued this is wrong because, I mean, he didn't quite say this, but putting it in today's terms, we would say, you know, the CEO of a company is going to be giving it maybe to his or her favorite charity rather than to the charity the shareholders like. And it'd be much better if the company paid a higher dividend, and then each shareholder can decide what part of the, that to give to their own favorite charity. So that that sort of argument won the day. And it's even enshrined in the law that, for example, pension money, well, sorry, let's come back to that in a moment. This is as I was saying, the conventional wisdom. Now, what I've argued in my recent work with Luigi Zingales, and also one paper, both with him and Eleonora Brocado, and by the way, we're not the only people arguing this, but we're certainly some of the people arguing it. What we've argued is that there are going to be a lot of situations where companies have a comparative advantage in choosing the socially appropriate action relative to individuals. So I think charitable contributions are not such an example. So we would be inclined to agree with Friedman on that. But when it comes, let's take a different example. Think of a company that can increase its profit and therefore its share price by dumping some waste into a river. So let's suppose that there's no law against this. There's no regulation against it. We might be talking about, let's say, a US-based company that could dump a toxic substance into a river in Africa or Latin America, where, let's say, regulations are less stringent. So according to, you know, so the conventional wisdom is, you know, if this is legal, the company should do it because it's going to increase its profit and it's going to make its shareholders wealthier. And that's what they want. But what we argue is, well, you know, if those shareholders are socially responsible citizens, they may actually, if they were asked whether they would be in favor of a higher dividend, but at the cost of polluting this river in Ecuador, they might say, you know what, that I don't want to do that. I don't want the company to do that. That doesn't make me feel good. I mean, by the way, this is not an action I can offset. You know, it's not as if the company makes more money and dumps the waste, then I can go and clean it up. I mean, that's crazy. Apart from the coordination problem among the many shareholders, there's also the fact that cleaning it up might be much more costly than not creating it in the first place. So if I had a vote, if the company asked me, I might say, no, please don't do that. I will put up with a lower dividend. And so, okay, that's what leads us to say that companies should be sensitive to shareholder preferences. And we call that maximizing shareholder welfare. So in this case, the higher dividend and dumping the waste would actually make shareholders worse off because they would be unhappy about this. They don't want it. And so if you're maximizing their welfare as opposed to their wealth, you might actually decide, no, we won't dump. That, in a nutshell, is the difference. So it's suggesting. So just to complete the thought, my co-authors and I continue to argue that it's appropriate for companies to act on behalf of shareholders. So some people have said companies should act on behalf of stakeholders, including not just shareholders, but workers, consumers, the local community. We don't go that far. Why not? Because companies are set up, we think, to act on behalf of shareholders. Why do we think that? Because shareholders are given the votes. You know, these other groups are typically not. You can set up your company to give votes to workers. You know, there are things called worker cooperatives, labor managed firms. They exist. But most of the companies, the big companies, the ones I was talking about, the Apples, the Qualcomms, the BPs of this world, they're not set up that way. So to the extent that the founders have allocated the votes to the shareholders, this, I think, is pretty strong evidence that the company's meant to act on their behalf. But what we are saying is that the preference of shareholders may be more complicated than the conventional wisdom has it, and that Friedman suggested.
I see. Do you think that the preferences of the shareholders could, in a sense, mirror the preferences of other stakeholders?
Yes, they could. And I think in some cases they will, because I think, for example, shareholders, and here I want to make it clear, maybe it's something you were coming to, but when I talk about shareholders, I mean the ultimate shareholders. So we're not talking about institutions. Many, many people hold shares through institutions, through mutual funds. And I don't mean them, the mutual funds. I mean the ultimate shareholders, so people like you and me. And we may, for example, care about workers, treatment of workers. And so, you know, if the company could look after its workers a bit better and reduce its dividend, we might say, yes, do it.
Interesting. And in your paper, you also highlight the use of moving beyond binary answers in voting, using Costco and its use of antibiotics in meat products as an example. So what are your thoughts on how such an issue could be approached?
Yes, I haven't read the paper recently, so you've read it more recently, actually. So when you say binary, non-binary, you mean more choices than just up or down, yes or no? Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's just provide some context. So if we're talking about Costco and the use of antibiotics in what, it's chickens or something, I can't remember what it was, but say it's really a matter of they could stop it altogether, or they could reduce it, or they could just keep going as they are. So this is these choices. So just to, again, to provide a bit more context, we argue in our papers that, you know, one way to take shareholder preferences into account is to have more voting. And so we like shareholder resolutions where people would have the opportunity, say, to call on the company to stop using antibiotics because of the harm it does to the greater public. If it's the case, and that, you know, if it was, if the choice is business as usual or stop, then that's something that you can easily handle in an up or down vote. If the choice is more complicated, you know, whether we should stop partially, it's going to be more difficult, unquestionably. I mean, you know, one way to do it is to have on the ballot those three possibilities. Let's say, I mean, it could of course be many more than three, but let's suppose the main choices are business as usual, complete stop, or a partial stop, which is sort of laid out. And so those are the three possibilities. You could have, you know, ranked choice voting. I mean, just as we do for political candidates, you know, some people argue, my colleague Eric Maskin at Harvard is one of the people who argues this very strongly, that, you know, in political elections, when you have more than two candidates, instead of having first past the post system, it's better to have ranked choice voting, where you just rank people 1, 2, 3, 4, and then, you know, the one with the least number one votes is eliminated, and then their votes are transferred to the other people, the twos become ones, and so on, and then you keep going until somebody wins with more than 50%. And you could do the same here with more than two choices. I'm not saying that's going to happen tomorrow. it's quite a hard fight in the political context to get it. So I think in the meantime, just having more things that shareholders can vote on, even if it's just binary, would be a great step forward.
Interesting. Well, you've shared very interesting insights throughout the whole conversation. We'd love to know from you, what advice do you have for students interested in economics and who are possibly willing to pursue it later?
You know, this is going to connect back a bit to my answer to an earlier question. So my advice to someone who's interested in economics is, first of all, bone up on your mathematical skills. I started off doing mathematics. That was my first degree. And although I sort of run out of steam on that, and actually was finding quite a lot of it tedious, this was 3 years at Cambridge where I did mathematics, nothing but mathematics, except, I mean, I did other things, but not academically. I didn't. And I think it was a bit much, actually. But still, it did provide a very good foundation for me in what followed, because I wasn't, you know, scared when I saw technical arguments, and indeed I thought I could understand them pretty well. So I think that's really important, and it's obviously much easier to do when you're young. So I would certainly recommend to anybody who's planning to be an economist, do some mathematics courses. This will be useful for theory. Then, of course, also, you know, probability theory and statistics, that's vital basis for empirical work in economics. So once you, you know, you've done those things, then, you know, I would say find out what you, what you're interested in, and pursue that. And if you want, if you're going to do research, I would try to ask interesting questions from the beginning. I mean, I think I did try to do that. I was saying that, you know, my early work was in extensions of the literature. That's true, but I was still, I think, trying to ask some interesting questions. I think certainly when you're doing a PhD, what I always tell students is, or, you know, if they ask me, is don't aim too low. Because I think when you do a PhD, your thesis, I mean, it's only the beginning of your research career, but if you, it's going, you're setting a standard for yourself. So if your thesis is too much a sort of small extension of the literature, you will probably get in the habit of doing that, as opposed to if you aim a bit higher. I mean, you can't aim too high. It's really would be, you know, how many PhD theses these days are sort of breakthroughs? I mean, the answer is basically none. It's too hard. And you don't have to aim for that. But aim moderately high, because as I say, then you'll know what that means, and that will help you in your future work. Whereas if you aim too low, I think you get in the habit of that, and you're likely not to be too ambitious going forward. So, okay, that's an answer to your question.
That's great advice. And are there any books, academic or non-academic, that you would recommend to our audience?
Okay, one book I recommend. So I teach a freshman seminar at Harvard, which is, that means, you know, 18-year-olds. And the way Harvard, you know, the way the American system works, as I'm sure you know, is it's less specialized. So these are people who may not have been exposed to much economics. They will do some economics at Harvard, whatever they're going to specialize in. But several, you know, it's a small discussion group, 12 people, and they come from all backgrounds. And some of them are planning to major in economics, but some are not. Anyway, a book that I have on my reading list that they all read and we discuss at length is John Stuart Mill's On Liberty. So I think this is a book I would recommend to any budding economist, because it's really, you know, lays out, I think, very well what many economists believe, which is that, you know, Mill's basic idea is that, you know, people should be left to do their own thing unless what they do is going to have a negative impact on other people, which in a lot of cases it won't. And so we shouldn't interfere too much. It's amazing that he, you know, he wrote about this so brilliantly, you know, when he did, which was, can't remember the date exactly, but 1800s. Anyway, but it still stands up extremely well. And my undergraduates can really connect with it, and they continue to refer to it throughout our semester. The course is about the role of government, so a lot of it's very applied. We talk about you know, should drugs be legalized, this kind of thing. But somehow Mill's book they refer to it again and again to understand the things we're talking about. And it's, you know, it's quite short. So On Liberty, I would recommend that to everybody. I didn't read it until, you know, I'm embarrassed to say I was quite old.
Well, I'll have to give that a read for sure too. Finally, something we ask every economist on our podcast: what gives you hope?
What gives me hope in for the world?
Yeah.
Well, I think there are many things going on which worry me quite considerably, but I take the view that most people, most of the time, are pretty decent. There's certainly some bad people out there, but I don't think they're the majority. I think what can go terribly wrong is if the majority sometimes are swayed by the views of some bad person. I'm, of course, history. You know, there's some terrible examples of that, but unfortunately, it's still happening. But I think on the whole, the majority is sane enough that they're not going to be too taken with extremists, so that my hope is that the extremists will lose. I'm gratified that, I mean, he's not the worst person ever, but I think Donald Trump has been very dangerous for America, and I'm glad, I feel some hope that I think his star is dimming. But who knows, you know, I may turn out to be wrong, but I hope not.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Professor Hart, for this amazing conversation. I've learned so much right from this conversation and from the other insights that you shared. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, you asked some very good questions, so thank you.